Hi, everybody, and welcome to a special Pop Dose podcast. I am Dave Lifton, and today we're going to be looking at the life and legacy of Lee Von Helm, who, as I'm sure you know by now, passed away on April 19th at the age of 71. But before we get to that, I want to bring in my co-host, Jeff Giles. Jeff?
Sup, fucker?
Not much.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. Well, at least that we've spoken.
It's been 5 months. Five long months.
Way too long. And so that's one of the things that I want to get to in this intro. We've gotten a lot of tweets and feedback from people who have been asking us about the future of the podcast because it has been so long. And we really appreciate all of you who have done that. So this is what has been going on. You know, as with any other hobby, when you get out of that rhythm of doing something regularly, you know, it's kind of hard to get back into it no matter how much you enjoy doing it. You know, kind of like going to the gym. You know, 1 week you don't go because your back is bothering you. And then it was a tough week at work, and then you went on vacation, and now multiply that by three people, and that's kind of what's going on.
How is your sciatica, Dave?
It's the sciatica is good, but the gout is still bugging me.
You know, it was a different kind of rhythm that actually fucked us up. Jason's been on paternity leave.
That's true.
Is what it's been.
Jason's wife gave birth to a beautiful baby girl, Ella Hare. So that's been part of it, and you know, when you've got a newborn baby, it's kind of tough to take a few hours out of your day and to get some peace and quiet to jump on Skype and make mom jokes. but when Lee Von died last Thursday, Jeff tweeted that he wished he could turn off the world for a while and just write about Lee Von. So I emailed him asking if he wanted to do a podcast about it, and he was up for it, and because Jason is not really what you would call an expert on Lee Von Helm, he might have heard of him. We decided to bring in a member of the Pop Dose family who is pretty much an encyclopedia of not only the band, but also of that wellspring of American music that the band took their cues from. So please welcome Judd Marcello. Judd, welcome to the show.
What's up, fuckers?
Thanks for joining us, Jed.
Hey, thanks for having me. You know, it's funny.
Coming all the way from London.
Yeah, I'm in London right now, so it's nighttime here. It's Sunday night. But the beauty of the internet is it's anytime, all the time. So nobody else needs to know that. But it's funny that, you know, you mentioned about the lack of the time between the podcast. Well, this is my first one, so, you know, I can't be held accountable for that. But when you say you just don't have time for doing things anymore, you just kind of fall out of that rhythm. It's really funny we're talking about Lee Von Helm and you call me part of the Pop Dose family because I'm like probably the biggest flash in the pan ever. because when I got invited by Jeff to be part of Pop Dose, I was all excited. I was in a serious rhythm with my blog and writing all the time and absolutely loving it. And then it just so happens that the time my enthusiasm for the blog ended, collided with my very first and only contribution to Pop Dose, which was my 6,000-word novel on my visit to Lee Von Helm's Midnight Ramble.
Which was very well received, by the way.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Yeah, it was surprising. I was surprised I actually finished that damn thing. I couldn't believe I actually wrote something that long. And to be honest, I mean, that's what happened. I think after that I was so burnt, I just said, I don't think I can write anything else. And I really haven't since.
Lee Von's people even linked to that, didn't they?
They did, and I think that's what made it explode. And then, you know, from there, you know, everybody, like me, you know, you call me an aficionado, and I am so much, I'm the most aficionado-esque on this podcast. But there's probably, you know, two or three people that are going to listen to this and say I'm full of crap. But yeah, at the
top. Those people suck.
They do suck. But yeah, I think that's the funny thing. You know, you get really passionate about something and you love it. And then when you write about it, I mean, you guys know this every day of your life when you write, I mean, people gravitate to it. And I think that's what happened with the Lee Von post.
Yeah. And it was such a thorough account of everything and written with such passion. We're going to link to it, in the show notes so that you can, so that everybody who hasn't already read it, can see it again.
What I did was at one point in time, and you look at what's happened in the past, so like 5 days or however long it's been. And, you know, I know I spent, you know, all of Friday night just looking throughout the internet, catching up on all the articles I missed and all the perspectives and all the adjectives and, you know, and all the tears that people expressed throughout what they wrote on their blogs or, you know, mainstream publications. I mean, everybody really has something to say about this in this area and from a music fan point of view.
Right. But let's start with you and your own history with Levon, both as a solo act and as a member of the band. What was it that made him such an inspiration to you?
Well, I'll tell you, I wrote about this too, so it really stems from when I was a young guy. So, you know, there was one particular moment that set a lot of all of this in motion for me, you know, not just my love of Levon, but for my love of music and becoming a real music fan. That's really kind of how I described it. I'll tell you the quick story. So early in high school, I think I was a freshman in high school, and just trying to be cool and trying to make the scene, you know, I was going to a lot of parties that I had no place being at, and just kind of showing up and being part of the backdrop and wanting desperately to get laid, to get loaded and not get punched or have beer poured on my head as, you know, some crazy freshman sitting in the corner. And one night, I was at one of these parties, and there was this one dude, and he was just at the tape deck, because there was tape decks back then in the 80s, and he just had all these mixtapes he brought with him to the party, and he just kept playing them over and over again. And everybody in the room knew all the words. I didn't know any of them. I didn't know the songs, but the whole place was just jumping on whatever he put on, you know, on the stereo. So by the end, I decided he must have been one of the coolest people in the room, because the chicks were hanging off him. The dudes loved him, and you know, and he was getting stoned and drinking and having a great time. So when he wasn't looking, I went over to his pile of tapes and I stole one, and I took it home. And so, you know, I buried it deep into my pocket and then proceeded to get wasted that night. I got loaded, I got stoned, but I didn't get laid. And I ended up, you know, I woke up on the floor of my bedroom in my parents' house.
So it was basically like Kiss Me Deadly by Lita Ford.
I didn't get in a fight,
went
though.
To a party last Saturday night, didn't get laid, got in a fight. All right.
Yeah, I'm a lover, not a fighter, but on that night I was neither. But yeah, so I woke up the next morning on the floor of my bedroom Saturday morning. I was like, oh, you know, just wipe the cobwebs off. And then I kind of just was going through the night in my head wondering, what did I do to embarrass myself? And I was looking through my pants and my jacket. And in my jacket I found the tape, right, that I stole. I was like, oh, shit, I stole that tape. That's right. And so I said, well, I might as well play it, you know. And so I popped it into the tape player, and I distinctly remember that it was rewound to side B. It had played through side A. So I said, all right, I'll just start it at side B. And I hit play, and the first song that came out, that was the first song on side B, was The Wait.
Hmm.
And because I was kind of hungover, and you know, my senses were, you know, on fire at the time, and as a young guy, and I put the tape in, and it was like a really cool discovery because I had stole it, you know, and I thought it was the Holy Grail, you know, I was anticipating what was coming out, and I just remember though that kind of like that plodding sound that The Wait starts out with, and just kind of coming out of the speakers, and really listening to it, you know, actually listening to what it sounded like, and feeling kind of a little bit overwhelmed by like, holy shit. I never really listened to this song before. This is some weird kind of like opening. What the hell does this sound like? Because back then I was just really interested in huge guitar chords, you know, anthemic party songs, and you know, anything that, you know, made chicks get excited. And this song was the complete antithesis of that. You know, I couldn't imagine any chick thinking that that was sexy. You know, that was cool, but it really just struck me. And I was like, holy shit, who is this guy? Listen to his voice. He's talking about Nazareth. Where are all the messages in here? You know? And it really confused me. And I was like, I don't get any of this shit. You know, and there's so many characters in it and all this. And it was just like music I had never really listened to before. You know, it was probably more like background noise. And that just really set me off. And I was like, holy shit, if this can offer me this, what have I been missing on all the other songs? And then, and I, really, honestly, that's what it was for me. That song just set it off. And then I was completely intoxicated by Levon. I was intoxicated by that song, The Wait. And then once you start learning about the rest of the music and the history and like where it all comes from and the influences and who did it before, and you realize these guys really didn't start it, you know, you just get sucked into it, and it's a complete rabbit hole. That's what got me. And then from there, you know, it was just a complete exploration into all of my favorites and finding out, you know, who started it for them. And it was a funny thing, and that led me to getting more involved with other people. So like so I remember listening to the Stones at the time. You know, it was like Start Me Up and some of the bigger songs that you knew. But then when you start to go back and find out, oh, they got their song, their name from a Muddy Waters song. Well, who is Muddy Waters? Oh, no shit. Mm-hmm. You know, look who he is. You know, and who did he learn from? Oh, he learned from Charlie Patton and this mythical figure named Robert Johnson, who apparently sold his soul. And as a young guy, you get all caught up in that. And then it just kind of like overwhelms you and you just want to know everything. And then it all starts to make sense in some weird way.
That's the way rock and roll is supposed to work, man.
I think so, man. And I totally, and that's the funny thing. I bought into the myth really early on, and I'm still stuck in it, you know?
This is the root of, Dave and I were talking with somebody else about why I hate the Black Keys.
Why is that?
Yeah, you know, it was after that interview where they slagged on Nickelback.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was, I'll cut out most of the argument, but what it boiled down to is that what those guys were saying kind of cut out everything that you're talking about. Like, the Black Keys are just as derivative as the Stones or Zeppelin or anybody else who borrowed. But the difference is that those guys wanted you to go back and learn about who they stole from.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things, and which is kind of one of the reasons why I got in trouble with this person for referring to the Black Keys as the Foghat of our generation.
That's not bad.
And I, you know, I don't really have too much of a problem with the Black Keys, but then again, I also don't have a problem with Foghat. But yeah, I think that's one of the things that is, you know, what you were talking about in his voice, you know, there's such an authenticity, the sound of America in Levon Helm's voice. You know, there's been so much discussion, and the Black Keys, I think, are kind of part of that as well, about authenticity and post-authenticity. And, you know, even in his keynote at South by Southwest a few weeks ago, Bruce Springsteen said that it wasn't as important as it once was. And I do think there's some truth there. And I think that all that really matters is that whether or not the music reaches you without necessarily needing to know everything behind it or where it comes from. But when Levon Helm opens up his mouth or goes into a drum roll, there was nothing about him that could ever be inauthentic. He came from, I think, a place and time where that was so important. You know, you think of like him and Johnny Cash, you know, coming from Arkansas and, you know, like the you know, very rural post-depression country where, you know, you think of like the values in that area of, you know, like a handshake being your word and, you know, standing up for the things you believe in and being able to back up your words with muscle if necessary. You know, that created that kind of authentic world that I don't think that with any other singer in the band, as great as Rick Danko and Richard Manuel were, mm-hmm. That they couldn't have been reached without Levon Helm there.
His voice is funny because, I mean, he was like 30 when those classic records were cut, and he still sounds like an antique. His voice was an instrument that was just, it existed outside of time, I think.
And yeah, and so were those songs. You know, they were very...
The songs weren't all him, though. I mean, he was the vessel for the songs. But it's just that his voice was the perfect vessel for that music, for those songs. I mean, I think there are probably people who argue that the band were not, quote-unquote, authentic because Levon was the only American in the group. And, you know, they were aping... a sound from an earlier time, and you know, it creates this question of, is it really authentic if you're trying to sound a certain way? I don't know, but his
but the
voice
idea is that Levon was the authenticity in there.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, and it's so true.
But
go ahead, Dave.
But I was saying, by the same token, the Stones, the Animals, the Yardbirds, they weren't authentic either.
Yeah,
right.
You know that they were, but sometimes the better perspective can come from the outsiders.
Sure.
Yes.
You know, and I think that's what Robbie brought in those songs and Levon drove home in the vocals. And Judd, what were you about to say?
Well, I was going to go back to what you said about authenticity. I think that after reading everything, you know, you read in the past few days and all the feelings that I've personally have had for Levon Helm over my years of appreciating the music, is authenticity is the word. Because it's almost like I think of him and maybe like Aretha Franklin as having true as true authentic voices, because Levon Helm never sets out to sing like himself. He just sings like himself, you know? And you use the Stones as an example. It's so true. It's like, take the Stones, for instance. Yes, they totally wore their influence on their sleeves, and they were happy to do it. They were excited to go to, you know, 2120 South Michigan Avenue and be at Chess Studios and to be there because that's where their heroes were. Like, you know, Levon's hero was his uncle who played, you know, the diddly bow, you know? For Mick Jagger, like, Mick Jagger continually, the reason why he is just continually shooting himself in the foot from a authenticity or even from a integrity level, because he's always trying to sound like what he thinks people want to hear. He's always trying to sound like the what he thinks he should be sounding like, or what the way he should be singing. Like, Levon Helm would never, ever put anything out like Goddess in the Doorway, right? you know what I mean? It's just like, Levon never set out to be anything but himself. And so that's all. It comes out in his playing. It comes out in his singing, his attitude. And that's what makes him authentic. He's never tried to sound like him. He's just him. And when you mention, like,
well, technically speaking, I think you would say that he was not as much of a singer as Mick. His voice was a blunt instrument, but it was lethal.
Fair enough. And that's why, because it was just what it was. Yeah. He didn't say, fuck.
Like a filled whiskey bottle.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't try to say, I really need to get a singing coach to work on my falsetto so I can sing Miss You. But, you know, you mentioned about Danko and Manuel not being as, quote unquote, authentic as Levon. In a way, they weren't, because they were really aspiring to be what Levon was. You know, in that whole sepia-toned existence that was the band, it's really based on Levon, in a sense, and all the other Canadians trying to capture a lot of that spirit and sing in that whole tone. And a lot of that's just appreciation for the music. They're happy for that, but Levon was it, man. I mean, he was the authenticity of the band. And, you know, I think everything else, if you took him out of it, I mean, not that we wouldn't have known it, but the band was just Bob Dylan's, you know, backup band when they toured England, and Mickey Jones was the drummer, not Levon.
Right, because he said, what did he say? I can take getting booed in my own country, but not overseas.
Yeah, yeah. but you know, you can take Levon out of the drum kit for that tour, you know. But you know, you can't see Mickey Jones replacing Levon in the context of what the band became or what the ethos was all about. You know, it was really about that dude and how he made all that happen.
You talking about taking him out? My best friend sent an email. He does some singing and playing down in Florida, and he sent an email saying that he was going to be, you know, where he was going to be performing this week, you know, for his mailing list and stuff, and then also said, you know, gave a shout out to, you know, to Levon. He said, without whom The Weight and The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down probably would have been sung by somebody else. So I wrote him back, and I said, you fucking jackass, without Levon, those songs wouldn't have even been written because he was feeding all the information to Robbie.
Yeah, so true.
Yeah.
You know.
So he sent me the video of him sitting in on The Weight, and he did the second verse, and I emailed him back saying, I think you just killed off Mavis Staples with that version.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling bound. I just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said. Take a load off, Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off.
Dave, what was your introduction to the band?
It would have had to have been just hearing The Weight on oldies radio and at some point liking it. And then when I was in college, you know, I don't remember. Maybe at some point I bought The Best Of. I know I bought it in college. I just don't know specifically when. And a bunch of times I would like see, even before college, I would catch the part of The Last Waltz on a pledge drive on PBS.
God bless PBS.
Right. And I remember this was before Roy Orbison's Black and White Night became the de facto. And now you get the Stax European tour, which is just the greatest thing ever. But but yeah, I remember like that was also my introduction to the Staple Singers.
Right.
You know, seeing that clip was just so mind blowing, and seeing the you know, hearing those harmonies and watching her sing that verse and do that swoop on "I said a hey come," and you know, it's just so remarkable. It that I think opened up my ears.
That movie is so interesting. It's such a night. It's just this huge collision between what the band was espousing musically and the nightmarish excess of the era.
Neil Young and the Traveling Booger Man.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly.
For those of you who don't know, I was actually watching the last Waltz last night. But for those of you who don't know, what happened was Neil Young came out, and nobody knew it until they watched the film. But he had a gigantic rock of cocaine stuck in his nose, and Elliot Roberts would not let his scene be used because of this. So Martin Scorsese, Elliot Roberts, who was Neil Young's manager, created a traveling net. that was just like right in the nose, and if you look, it's like blacked out. Like a little portion of his nose is completely blacked out, and they called it the Traveling Booger Mat.
And Neil clearly was not the only one who was partaking that night.
No, I think in Barney Hoskins' book about the band, it was just like a gigantic. It was the buffet, basically.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, it was literally. So I read the Bill Graham autobiography or biography, or whatever. I think it was autobiography. And what he did was, you know, because he was who he was and outlandish, he had one room backstage that he had painted completely white, and he went out and bought hundreds and hundreds of those Groucho Marx eyes, nose, mustache glasses. Had them, all the glasses and eyebrows and mustache stripped off, and then taped all of the noses onto the wall. And then in the middle of the room was a massive table that was a giant mirror, so everybody could go in there.
Jesus Christ.
And do blow.
Which has literally nothing to do with the music.
No. Right. No.
But one of the things that struck me in watching it last night, the thing that I thought was the funniest thing in the movie...
Van Morrison's outfit?
Even funnier than that.
Oh, no.
Because Van's performance is just so great. Yeah. During I Shall Be Released, it's the last scene, everybody, you've got like five microphones, and everybody's surrounded by microphones, and in the back is Ronnie Hawkins holding a cup. Oh. He's nowhere near a microphone. He has no idea what fucking song they're singing. He's just like talking to Levon in the middle of the song. It's like, I don't know what I'm doing. What are they singing?
So true.
And I had never noticed that before. In the 20 times in my life I've seen The Last Waltz, I don't think I ever noticed that. It never struck me that he wasn't even participating. But yeah, so it was seeing The Last Waltz and just really getting into that. And then, you know, reading Barney Hoskins and Levon's books fairly close to each other in the probably around 93, 94 or so, that really got me very interested in the idea of the mythology of what they were doing. What about you, Jeff?
I was thinking about this last night, and I was trying to remember. I think it might have... This is super embarrassing. I think it might have been... Rod Stewart's cover of Broken Arrow. Made me aware. I mean, I knew who Robbie Robertson was, but I didn't listen to his first solo record when it came out. And then, you know, Broken Arrow, that's a nice cover of a nice song.
Yeah. That was 89, was it? Was that on Out of Order?
91.
Which album?
And then
was
that? That was on Vagabond Heart.
Right. That was an intro. Okay.
And then Storyville came out, Robbie's second solo record, Storyville, uh-huh, came out later that year, which I reviewed, but had no appreciation for. And then the first band record that I bought was High on the Hog.
Oh, wow.
I know. Totally ass backwards.
Yeah.
I don't think I owned any band original band albums until Capitol started reissuing them in the late 90s. So it took me a long time. And it was obviously a very complicated route to get to their music.
Seriously, one of the things, I mean, I had started to get into them like in 92 or so. And then I bought a vinyl copy of Cahoots. And that kind of stopped me from listening to them for a while.
As it should.
Yeah. And it's funny, we talk about like bands that, you know, we were just talking about Guns N' Roses being basically inducted for Appetite for Destruction, and you could also say Use Your Illusion 1 and 2.
Right.
And, you know, the band, so much of their legacy was really just those first two records.
The first two records, absolutely.
Yeah, but, I mean, they still had some great songs interspersed within, like Ophelia and Life is a Carnival and Stage Fright, It Makes No Difference, all the stuff that's on their best of.
But, yeah, you know, sometimes those that happens. I mean, it's, you know, rock's history is littered with that kind of flash-in-the-pan stuff. It's just that those guys were so much part of the scene, they were so revered, they just didn't seem to go away, even when they weren't producing great albums or, you know, putting out their best stuff after it faded off.
Right. Well, they also did Rock of Ages, which is a fantastic live album.
Fantastic.
In addition to The Last Waltz. A lot of people, you know, always point to The Last Waltz. I think as a live album, Rock of Ages is probably better. And the amazing thing about Alan Toussaint writing those horn charts right there that day because he left them in the car or something. That's
remarkable. That's nuts.
Yeah. But
I think, you know, and then the band also, you know, they backed up Bob Dylan on Planet Waves. So, you know, they were a backup band there. Then they went out and toured together on Before the Flood.
Right.
You know, they could have done it themselves, but they end up, you know, just being part of something again.
Right.
But I think their presence on that tour goes to the heart of what their music meant and probably what people on one level respond to even now, which is that things mean more if you're in them with somebody else.
As opposed to doing...
Well, like Judd said, they could have gone out and done something on their own, but they did it with Bob. Oh, okay. You know, like they threw in their lot with him, and that's when things really work, is when you throw in your lot with somebody else. This together. And I think that was kind of the underlying message of what they were about.
You know, just thinking of that notion of, you know, playing all together and, you know, throwing your lot in with somebody else. You think of somebody like Larry Campbell.
Yep. That's all he's ever done.
Like, I challenge you to go find one of his albums anywhere, his solo albums. It's so hard to do, let alone anywhere digitally. You know, I'm a fool. I should have bought him when I was there, but I didn't. But, you know, he's a guy, he played with Dylan for a number of years, right? So, you know, he went around with Dylan. He's like, great, this is exactly where I want to be. You know, he's an ultimate sideman, yes. But at Levon's place, he is like, not just in it, he is the band leader. He is controlling
Larry
everything.
Campbell
he's
is human
the
glue. That's who he is.
He is, absolutely. And, you know, to your point, I can't find his solo album anywhere. And if it was that damn good, then I would be able to. But when you go see him live, and you're there, and he's just singing Volvere, and it's like shaking the rafters, and it's just so impressive. You know, it's you just know this guy is magic. But you know that's where he has to play. That's
where the magic happens, man.
Yes, I went down to the river on a Saturday morning. I was looking around just to see who was born. I spied a little chicken down on its knees. I went up and yelled to it, please, please, please. He said, don't you tell Henry, don't you tell Henry, don't you tell Henry, apples got your fly.
You know, it's funny too when we talk about, like, I'm gonna kind of switch a little bit to, like, not just leave on the singer and the songwriter and all that, but, you know, did you guys make it to a Midnight Ramble?
No.
Okay. So
I wanted to. I talked about it for every year that I've lived here, and I didn't bite the bullet, and now I'm going to regret that for the rest of my life.
He was just here a month ago. He was just here a month ago in Chicago, and it was a benefit for the Old Town School where I spend a lot of time, and it was a benefit. The tickets were just way too much for me, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I get it. That does happen, whether it's time or money, or I'll get it next time.
Uh-huh.
You know, in the end, you always say I should have done it. But
yep.
When I was there, right? And I went three times last year, but especially the first time, and I wrote a lot about this, the entire event is an extension of that authenticity. You know, it really is, because the whole place feels as though he's allowing you to be part of his existence. You know, he's not selling you a ticket to be at his gig. He's just allowing you to be a part of his existence. And you feel that from all the people that you deal with as well. From the guy who gives you the ticket when you drive down the end of his driveway, to the people that bring out some ponchos for you when it's raining out, you know, so you don't get wet. You know, to the woman who, you know, takes extra 10 minutes to ask where you're from, how'd you get here, you know, what's your favorite song or whatever, before she really tries to sell you anything from their merchandise table, you know. And then also for, like, people like me who made the trip, you know, from wherever they go, you know, everybody's really there as a community thing. I brought pies from the local bakery. People brought homemade lasagnas, cookies, all kinds of things. I mean, people brought this stuff from far and away. They made it the night before because they were so excited to contribute to it. I mean, it's all just an extension of who the guy, you know, really was. And you felt that in the place, too, you know. Everyone is really respectful of the event, you know.
Right. I think that probably goes back to the idea, and one of the things that I wanted to bring up, one of the things that often comes to mind when I think of Levon are those two interview segments in The Last Waltz where he talks about growing up in Arkansas in the 40s and 50s and seeing the traveling shows and how all those styles of music that were floating around combined to create rock and roll. And in the scene where he talks about the Walcott's Rabbit's Foot minstrel show, you know, that's probably what that was like, how it was this, you know, on Saturday nights, everybody came with pies and other foods and stuff. And that means that he, you know, in terms of how our entertainment options have changed since then, you know, he and maybe somebody like Del McCoury, who's a year older than Levon, I think.
Just a year?
Yeah.
Damn.
He was born in 39. But the idea of these are the last remnants who witnessed firsthand what Grail Marcus called the old weird America in his book about the basement tapes.
Yeah.
You know, and how that is just such, how that's basically disappeared now.
I think it bears mentioning that, unless I'm remembering this wrong, those rambles started because Levon needed money.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think that part of the reason that we loved him so much was that he seemed like he needed it, you know? Like, I think people felt like, well, I don't know, maybe I'm overstating this, but I would guess that part of that feeling of wanting to bring, you know, lasagnas and pies and come to his gathering and be with him and soak in his existence was that I think people, to an extent, felt like that he needed it, that they were giving him something that just as much as he was giving them.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what made him so appealing was that everybody knew that he, to put it mildly, suffered for his art. I mean, he did not live a perfect life. You know, that I think that added to the impression of this authenticity that we're talking about was that he seemed like he lived his life the way he made his music.
Hard. he said that in I think it was in 2000 he had the Rolling Stone interview, like it was a long one. I reread it this weekend. I think it was right after Rick Danko died, and in it he said there's two things people don't want in life: poverty and cancer. And now I've got them both. Yeah. Right, or I've had them both. And you're right. I think that whole thing did come out of the fact that he said, you know, you either got to pay your medical bills or you got to pay your mortgage bill. And I chose to pay my medical bill. And it was a sense of community. And it probably, you know, it started locally because everybody loved him locally. You know, at one point his barn burnt to the ground. And then, you know, the local craftsmen came and rebuilt it for him out of the kindness of their heart. You know, and it was like old fashioned carpentry with pegs and you know, no nails, that kind of thing. And they built a beautiful place for him because the respect they have for him, you know. But you're right. I think that probably then it took on a life of its own. And then people said, I really hear what's going on there. That's a wonderful sense of community. We all kind of want that. I want to be part of that too. And so then, you know, and that's what the Ramble became. It wasn't just a night of music. It was a night of community. Yep. And then when you put the two together, I mean, to be inside that place when, you know, there are 12 to 15 musicians, you know, playing on the floor, and some of them are absolute legends, and there's only 200 people in the room, and, you know that you're in Levon Helm's house, and it is, it's an unbelievable feeling. You know, it's really, I'm not a religious person at all. And it was incredibly spiritual. I mean, that's how I felt about it. You can say that I'm nuts and that I'm overly emotional about it, but yeah, 9 out of 10 people will tell you the same, and the other person was just got too drunk before he went in.
No, man, I think the act of making music is a spiritual experience. I love watching musicians speak that language, and I'm always going to be envious of you for going.
Yeah. And I think one of the things, and, you know, talking about that experience again and being in there, you know, and wanting to give, you know, there's a lot of fans that want to give, you know, like there's people that they just want to meet the Black Keys and give them their undying love, you know, and as a fan, you want to meet your heroes and you want to give them something. You want to give them some kind of appreciation. You know, you want to give them a hug, or you just want to tell them something stupid that means nothing to them, but you just got to get it off your chest. But in the sense,
Jeff gave Joe Henry herpes.
We'll talk about Joe Henry in a minute.
Okay.
But, you know, you do that, and when you go to Levon's, it's different. You feel like you're going there, and you're giving back. You're contributing. And that's why I wrote, yeah, too. I think I wrote a number of times. You completely feel as though you're part of the music. You know, you're clapping along, and you're singing, and you're kind of supposed to. You know, like, oh, that's your fill, you know, with your hand clap. You know, you got the low end of this sing-along. And it felt – that's why it felt really spiritual. While we were there, what was really cool, like – the first time I went, the opening act, it wasn't anybody I knew. But it was fine because I just wanted to be there, which is unbelievable. The second time I went, I took my wife because she loves Levon. She's a big fan. And you know, she only likes a sliver of what I like. And this happened to be, you know, we marry up here. While we were there, you know, Jimmy Vivino, he's the leader of Conan O'Brien's band on TV. Yeah. He's a longtime friend of Levon and all these people connected in that region of New York. And this guy played. He was unbelievable. And I didn't know who he was, but a lot of people did in the room. You felt like this guy really mattered to the event. And he was just really giving of himself for the time, you know, like giving to the crowd and giving to the whole event. And he felt at home, and you could feel that. So you felt at home. And then the third time I went, which was really cool, was Dawes was there, and then Jackson Browne came out. So Dawes was there, and you knew they loved it because they talked about it. And I'll tell you a funny story about Dawes. But when Jackson Browne came out, he came up and he said, "Look, I've been trying like hell to find my way into this barn. I've wanted to be part of this so bad because it's everything I've heard about is everything I want." And he goes, "I had to piggyback on my friend's Dawes to be able to get in here." You know, he couldn't get in the door. And he was so excited to be there. And you could see the genuine smile on his face. And, you know, of course, you kind of have your eye on the biggest star in the room. So you're looking over at him during the songs. And the guy's singing along to all the band songs at the top of his lungs and having a great time. And, you know, and backslapping with some of the other guys and saying, "Oh, did you hear that? Oh, that was great." And you can feel it. You know, you can really see it. And then he got to sing two songs. He sang a couple songs with Dawes. And then he sang two songs by himself. And he said, "They asked me what I wanted to sing. And I wanted to sing 'It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry,' you know, Bob Dylan song." And yeah, it was cool because it's like, I never got a chance to play that before, you know. So it was just cool to see a massive rock musician, right, a massive rock star, whatever, you know, feeling humbled by that same similar type of event and just wanting to be part of the scene. You know, that was cool.
Jackson could have West Coast rambles, man.
He could. But you know what?
I bet you he never would.
No, because, you know, he's not going to open up his door to anybody.
Exactly, but, you know, exactly.
Maybe because he doesn't need to. He doesn't have cancer or poverty. But but it's funny, you know, you mentioned, Dave, about not having that experience anymore. That just doesn't happen. You know, it doesn't. You know, when I look at, like, what's his name? Daryl Hall and his Live from Daryl's House. You know, I look at it and go, you know, he might be able to do something like what Levon does. He could bring some people in there. But you know what? It just seems really plastic. It doesn't seem like it would ever have that real authenticity to it. It would have this ulterior motive in a way.
Yes.
You know? So it
Amen.
Is time. It's people, it's time and place. You know, and he just happens, Levon was just that guy that's been this legacy of authenticity from a very from a time when all that shit just bubbled to the surface and everybody felt real about it, like it mattered, you know.
And also, I think that was his last card to play. You know what I mean?
I mean, why do you say that?
Because I wonder, I don't think, if he hadn't been forced into that corner, I don't think that the Rambles would have occurred to him.
Yeah.
It's just that that was his last bit of currency that he had to offer, and it ended up being this really special thing.
It's so true. And who knows, he might not have made his Grammy-winning albums because of that. Maybe he would have just, you know, went off into the sunset and fished or something.
Exactly. That's kind of what I was getting at when I said the Jackson could do West Coast Rambles, but he won't because he's set. You know, it would take somebody who had a little bit of name value and really needed the cash to do it. And Levon was the guy.
Right. I think that I'm glad that you mentioned Dawes. Jeff, I know you're not that much of a fan of them.
They're okay. They're kind of like something that fell out of Jackson Browne.
Right. Well, to me, they remind me, they're Jackson Browne songwriting with the band's music, or at least with their harmonies. And I like that because it... Jackson Browne, the world-weary existentialist songwriter, not the misogynist songwriter.
Yeah, I don't think Dawes has Jackson's lyrics.
No.
Right. But by the same token, you're not going to get Take It Easy, Your Redneck Friend. So it's a good trade-off, but you do get those really incredible harmonies that the band were so great at. Yeah. So I think I'm glad that for Dawes that they got to... be part of a ramble or two, or maybe more, because I think they said that because they are so influenced by that as well.
A rich man step on my poor head. When you get back, you better butter my bread. Well, you know that it's just like I said.
So now we've talked so much about who he was. One of the things that I think has really not been covered as much when talking about Levon recently was him as a drummer. Somebody said, as far as singing drummers, there's Levon Helm, Grant Hart, and everybody else. You know, which is true.
Who was it that said he's the only drummer who can make you cry?
It was a writer.
Yeah. That was actually the other thing that I was thinking of. Yeah, that line. And that is true, because you listen to some of his fills, some of his drum fills, you hear just like in the middle of it, all of a sudden, like you would hear like an extra crack on the snare. I was trying to find the exact information last night, but I couldn't find it. But he had like a Gretsch kit that was like from the 1890s or something that he found early on in the it was either after Big Pink or before Big Pink. It was like on those first couple of records, and it just sounded like wood. And that goes, I think, so much to the band's sound, in that old-time sound, because they were using electric guitars and Wurlitzer organs instead of Hammond organs. But, you know, I mean, they were an electric rock and roll band. But that sound rooted it in that old-time, the sound of Levon's drums rooted it in that old-time feel that they were going for.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a drummer. I'm not even a musician. I've been teaching myself guitar lately, but I'm horrible. So I lose a lot of the technical stuff about what you're talking about, or, you know, when people talk about the drum sound, like I'm watching, I don't know how many videos recently, and Jim Keltner was talking about how he pauses when he's playing a certain time, and I don't understand all of that. But just from a technical musical theory standpoint, But I think what you're talking about, like what really stands out, what I think about when you're mentioning that, is if you've ever seen that classic album video or that episode, mm-hmm. when they do the Brown album, the band album. Yeah. I love that show, and I wish that somebody would come out with technology that would just let me have a mixing board at home and do that to every album I own.
Yep.
I would kill for that. But what I love, Dave, about that is that you know, they're at the mixing board, and John Simon was there because he produced that album, and he's with Levon at one point, and, you know, whoever else. And they're just pulling up and pushing down, you know, all the different instruments so you can isolate stuff. And when you when they were isolating things like Garth's, I remember Robbie Robertson was doing it one time to Garth's organ piece on a particular song. And when he did it, you all of a sudden heard something you just didn't hear before because it was, you know, singled out. But it was like this merry-go-round sound, you know, this calliope, you know, and it's like, it's a total kids park sound, you know, in the middle of this classic song. And, but it's that old timey feel that everybody's kind of playing with together that creates that, you know, that like what is that old weird America, that sound to it all.
The great thing about that was, and this was at the time of like every white rock and roll band trying to sound soulful and using Hammond organs, and Garth Hudson was using a Wurlitzer, which was so different. And that's why like, their keyboard sounds were so unique, and also he was just such a tinkerer as well that he could get that calliope thing going. And the other thing on his drums, if you listen to Up on Cripple Creek, I mean, think of how much we've heard that song. If you listen to the verses, every four bars or every two bars, what he's doing changes. The first two bars, when I get off this mountain, you know where I'm going to go, he's playing the drums, he's playing a rhythm one way, and then when he goes into the next two lines, he completely changes it, he's playing an entirely different shuffle. And he does that on each verse. It's really amazing. Listen to the song next time you're you're doing it.
I'll pick it apart.
Okay.
Most bands have interchangeable parts. That was not one.
Right.
Yeah.
There's nobody that you could take out of that band, not even Garth.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it also helped that they were multi-instrumentalists. You know, when Levon moved to mandolin, Richard would take over on drums, and Garth could play saxophone, Danko could play fiddle.
And they were all very distinctive with what they did.
Yeah.
Right.
My favorite part, it's been a while since I've seen that episode of Classic Albums, but doesn't Garth play the intro to Chest Fever?
Yeah, he does.
And then when he's done, he just kind of shrugs?
Yeah. He does, and you know, and I think there's some, in that one, there's also some footage of them in a little, you know, log cabin type setting in Woodstock somewhere, yeah. And there's actual footage of them playing at one point. And there's, I think it's Cripple Creek actually, or it's King Harvest, I forget. But there's this one part in the song where they are the camera's on Garth, right? And he's playing. You know, he has that weird way of his hands are just kind of fingers are just dancing along there. And all of a sudden he does something or he hears something and he just starts laughing to himself. And it's it looks so maniacal, you know, just because he looks like he's in another dimension to everybody else. And he might be listening to a complete song that nobody else is to, but he heard some weird thing that just makes him kind of laugh hysterically to himself. And it looks scary. he was at one of the rambles, the last ramble I went to. He showed up that night Dawes was playing.
And he didn't sit in at all?
He did. No, he did. He played a long time. Okay. He and Jimmy Vivino did a tribute to Richard and Ricky, as everybody there was calling him. They did a tribute to them and just played their songs. And, wow. You know, Garth was just like, when he came out, I shit myself because I was already there to see Dawes, which was fantastic. And then Jackson Browne came out. And then Donald Fagen was in there, so you know he was coming. And then out of nowhere, Garth Hudson comes out. And, you know, I was just, you know, one of those things where you yell so loud you almost black out. And then, you know, it's like a total little girl at, you know, some black and white footage of someplace in London when the Stones were first playing. But, and then he came out, he's a weird little, he's an introverted guy, like introverted when he's visible, you know?
Yeah.
You barely saw his eyes. And when he
seems borderline autistic in that footage.
You know something? It's very much so. And it was like an elderly autism. He was just very much in his own place, but it was just that same thing. His head was down and he was wearing an old, he was wearing a Flying Burrito Brothers, a satin Flying Burrito Brothers jacket. And it was that version of Flying Burrito Brothers that he played on somewhere in the 80s. And, and he had a trucker hat on and he just, it was, and he had this massive beard and, gray and white beard. And I think that, Jimmy Vivino, when he came out that night, he said, I'm going to do some stuff right now. Normally I play the guitar, but I'm going to play the piano. We're going to play some songs for Richard and Rick. But, you know, I really feel like, you know, if I'm going to sing these songs, I need the help of God. But since I couldn't get God, I got the next closest thing to him that looks like him. And then Garth came out, and he just sat there. He didn't say much at all, but he just kind of had his head down, you know, scrunched over, and just his hands were like high above his head and just playing on, you know, everything.
I'm guessing Jimmy broke out the falsetto.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, it was cool. But I think it goes back to, you know, what you were talking about before. It's like, you know, people just locked in to what they play and the style that they play it, you know, and it all just kind of fit within all of that arrangement. But I think that classic album for me, you know, that really, you start to appreciate all the complexity in that music. And then when you hear it, everybody always says, oh, it's such simple music. You know, it's the simple kind of music. It's not...
Deceptively simple.
Right? It's completely deceptively simple. And you watch that classic album, you know, you're just like, holy shit, man. There's a lot of stuff going on in here. You know, kitchen sink and all.
Good luck had you strung me to the racetrack I did go. She bet on one horse to win and I bet on another to show. The odds were in my favor, I had them 5-1. And that nag to win came around the track, sure enough we had won. Up on Cripple Creek and she sends me in my spring a leap. And she wins me, I don't have the speed, she defends me.
The sad thing about this happening is that we're in for another 5 to 10 years more of this.
That's true.
With a lot of guys and women, guys and gals going. Just
you know what happened
time.
To our parents and their parents. This is what happens. You know, you have heroes and then they die. Levon at least was 71. I mean, that isn't old. He wasn't he was still vital, but 71, he had a pretty good run. He lived a lot of life.
A lot.
He lived probably 150 years worth of life.
He lived longer than my dad, and my dad didn't do half the shit that he did. or didn't do anything Levon did. Let's put it that way. You know, it's funny.
You can be happy about that.
Yeah. I think, you know, like Springsteen is 62 and he's given 3-hour concerts, you know. Yeah. 62, my dad couldn't watch TV for 3 hours straight without falling asleep.
Well, how old is Eddie Van Halen? And he's got an artificial hip.
Yeah.
So I would say, Judd, we probably have a good 20 years of this. I'd say probably from here on out, the three of us are going to watch people whose music we love die.
Yeah.
See, for me, that's always happened. I mean, yeah, it's probably going to happen more, but I mean, I remember I was already a Beatles fan for 4 years when John Lennon died. So almost all of the original Rolling Stones are still alive. You know, and I've seen two guys from The Who die. You know, two members of the E Street Band die. You know, so it is something that we are dealing with, but it's also...
And the members of Poison and Bon Jovi will outlive all of us.
Fuck those assholes.
Every time a legend dies, CeCe DeVille has another shot. From Aldehyde. It's a horrible world.
I'm going to try. I'm going to see what I can do to have that put on your tombstone, Judd.
I'll have to roll over twice.
Well, they blew up the Chicken Man in Philly last night, and they blew up his house too. Down on the boardwalk, they're ready for a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state, and the DA can't get no relief. Gonna be a rumble on the promenade, and the gambling commissioner's hanging on by the skin of his teeth. Everything dies, baby, that's a fact. But maybe everything that dies, someday he comes back. Put your makeup on, fix your hair up pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City.
All right, so we're going to close this out, and if we have anything left that we want to say about Levon, you know, go ahead.
Take it away, Jeff.
I can't say anything that Joe Henry didn't say. I foreshadowed this.
Yeah, you were going to talk about...
What, 20 minutes ago? Did you guys read what he wrote?
No.
He put up something on his site before Levon passed, but after it had been announced that it wasn't going to be very long. And I would just urge everybody to read it because, you know, anybody who's friends with me on Facebook knows that I do not pass up any opportunity to tell Joe Henry how much his music means to me. And Joe did the same thing for Levon. And wrote a very beautiful, very moving sort of farewell to Levon as he lay between life and death, talking about what Levon's music had meant to him personally. So I'm not going to try and be any more profound than Joe was the other night when he wrote that. Look it up. It's called Gone, Not Gone, Levon Helm in Motion. And, yeah.
Do you think that in the last 10 years, in the post-Ramble phase of his life, do you think that Levon got to finally understand what he meant to so many people?
I hope so. He saw enough of them pass through the barn door.
Okay.
What I worry about is that, you know, I think that on one level, the band, when they were active, were a sort of self-conscious reaction to the plasticization of pop music, if that makes any sense. I mean, they were self-consciously hearkening back to a time when music didn't sound perfect. And now it's easier than ever for music to sound perfect. And I wonder if we're going to get anybody who sounds the way the band did. And if we do, I think the fact that they sound that way will be even more self-conscious than the band were 40 years ago, which it troubles me a little bit. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, Pro Tools and Auto-Tune are so pervasive now that just the act of not using them is kind of making a statement. Like, just the act of fucking making music and not trying to fix it when you're done is making a statement.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because the thing that got me to listen to the first Counting Crows record when I read about them before I bought it the day after I read an article about them was that there were no overdubs on it.
Like, Dave, you know that one of my favorite things is a singer who can't really sing.
Right.
And Levon definitely fits that mold. I would say Joe Henry probably fits that mold, too.
And I his think most Levon recent... Helm is a great singer.
But not technically.
No, I think he's technically a great singer.
Not... Do you?
Yeah.
Because I think that Levon...
It's a strong voice.
It didn't really matter if Levon hit the note.
But he did. But it did matter because he was singing three-part harmony. And if you have a bad note in harmony...
Yeah. You're right.
It's fucked up. No, was it a pretty voice? It was the raw sound of dirt.
Yes,
but at the same time...
absolutely right.
But at the same time, it wasn't Dylan-esque voice.
Right.
It was absolutely a strong, clear, in-tune voice.
Yes.
That just had a ton of all these other things, and this is one thing that I wanted to say in my final thing, that for me, the genius of Helm, especially as a singer, was that he could make a New York Jewish liberal feel empathy and a degree of kinship with Johnny Reb.
Mm-hmm.
By all rights, when I listen to The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, I should be going, good fucking riddance.
Right.
You know?
But you feel, yeah.
But you just understand so much of what he's singing in, both in the song and not just because the song is so good, but because the vocal is so great.
I would say a guy like Joe is a standard bearer for the same spirit that the band that was in the band's music. Like his most recent record, he recorded with the studio windows open and they cut it all live. Joe doesn't sound anything like Levon, but that, I mean, that's music. That's music as it happened, and you get to hear what the musicians did instead of what it sounded like after they fixed it in the mix.
Right.
But you have to, I guess my question always is, what, in this time right now, with the technology that's available to musicians, what is artifice anymore? I don't know if it's that easy to answer the question anymore.
Well, I think that goes to the question of authenticity and post-authenticity, that it's not as important as it once was.
Which is fucked up.
Or sometimes it's just not as accessible as it once was, I think. You know, the influences that we're talking about just, they kind of don't exist anymore. They exist in somebody's photo album or in, you know, these kinds of records or, you know, or history books or anything that Grudeau Marcus writes. You know, it's...
But if you heard that some young band was running off to a barn in upstate New York to cut their record with no overdubs, I think I would roll my eyes a little bit, wouldn't you?
No, I'd want to hear it.
I'd want to hear it, certainly.
I'd want to hear it because I knew that they were coming from that point and because they were influenced by it.
Were they coming from that point or from one degree removed?
They're coming.
What
it may be.
And what is authenticity anymore? God damn it! I don't even know what I'm saying.
But see, it's a one degree removed, but it's also the same degree removed as Levon was from a front porch.
Right.
You know it. It's the idea that, yeah, I want to make music that sounds as good as what the band made, and at least try to. If I can't capture that spirit, then at least I can try to see where they were coming from.
It's something that I struggle with. I interviewed the guys from Spirit Family Reunion.
Right.
And they do something similar. And I like the Felice Brothers also, you know. Young guys who sound like they were bred in a moonshine jug.
Right.
And, it's just something that I always have to ask myself, what is it that I want to hear when I listen to that music, and what is it that I'm actually hearing? And they're just questions that people didn't have to ask themselves when Big Pink came out.
Yeah, it's just such an intangible thing, authenticity. You know, today's authenticity is authenticity. It's just not what we're... When we think about authentic, we think about something that's tweed, you know? you know?
And please start writing again.
Yeah, you know, like we said early in the podcast, somebody said about Dawes, well, they just, you know, yeah, they kind of have that something that fell out of Jackson Brown, but they'll never have those lyrics.
Right.
You know, it's like, are we going to fault them for trying to be authentic, you know, or being as authentic as they think they are? I mean, it's just one of those intangible things. I think, for me, I think there's something that always stands out in my mind when I hear this, and I don't know if you guys ever read that. Fantastic, might have been the greatest music book I've ever read. Sweet Soul Music by Peter Guralnik.
I've read some other stuff of his.
You really should read this book. It's phenomenal. And there's this one passage in it, and it's early in the beginning, and he's talking about all these blues artists from a long time ago and the soul artists and how, you know, a lot of the soul artists came from gospel, and they kind of all had these shared experience. And I'm reading it. I'll read it to you. And he's talking about all these people, right? And he's talking about why their music is so authentic. He writes, they sing from the heart, music that is deeply engraved in their background and experience. All make reference to this in one way or another. They recall a boyhood in the country, on the farm, a sharply delineated group of men and women who grew up in circumstances probably very much like their own, who all responded to the music, not just as entertainment, but as a vital part of their lives. So I think of Levon Helm when I hear that, because...
Right.
That's what he was doing, you know? I mean, it was just what he did. So when he was down and out, he had a ramble. You know why? Because when somebody's hogs got killed by a wolf, they got together to earn enough money so they could go buy a new hog,
right. You
know, back in Turkey Neck, Arkansas, or Turkey Scratch, Arkansas. But I think when I think of Levon, I think we're probably losing. We're going to lose a lot of people like we talked about in the next 20 years or whatever it may be. But we're probably not going to lose too many more originals. And that guy was a real original in the sense that he brought along his life into whatever he did. His music, his ups and downs, you know.
Well, you can also
he made choices.
I think that what we're getting at here is the idea of more like where our society is, in that we are much more interconnected now. Levon Helms was an original and an authentic person because he came from a world that we could never understand. You know, me growing up in suburban Long Island in the 80s, you know, singing about a Dust Bowl era mentality and all of those experiences coming into his music, you know, whoever the great musicians of today are singing about their experiences, but we understand them more because we're much more interconnected now than in those days. So it maybe doesn't.
But by the same
across...
token, don't you think it's also easier to approximate an experience that you wish you had had? You know, you've absorbed Levon's music. I have. Judd
right.
has.
Mm-hmm.
Give us enough whiskey and enough time, and we could bang out a song that self-consciously stabs at that aesthetic.
I hear where you're going with it. What I'm hearing is, like, you know, I think maybe from my kind of parting Levon thoughts is, I don't think you have to have this argument at all when you talk about Levon Helm.
Right.
And that's the thing I love about it the most. It's never in question. You know, the man or his music is never really in question because it's really the exact same thing. And I think for me, you know, authenticity is the word for him. And I'm just going to really miss that because not that I won't get to listen to his music forever, but I just remember being in his barn, especially the last time and last December. And at the end, I just like, okay, soak it all in. This is really important to you. You know, this means a lot, you know, and appreciate this and fully appreciate this moment and stop for a minute instead of rushing out or just letting it be a fleeting thing. And I don't know, there's not much music or people in music that do that to me, you know, and make me stop and feel that way. And I think the more that you feel about the music or the people that make it, whether they're songwriters or drummers or singers, you know, that's why it really matters to you. And I think that's why this really bums me out that Levon died, because that just doesn't exist anymore. You know, he doesn't exist anymore, and that doesn't exist anymore. And that just kind of bums me out, you know, because every time I listen to his album, you know, it was time, one of his songs, it's time well spent. And I always feel really good about it. You know, it's compelling stuff. I feel invested in it. And even though it's a really timey period type thing, it's really timeless, you know, and I feel really fortunate that I got to go and to be there with my hero and kind of wave at him, you know, like a total loser. I'm waving at him when he's waving at the crowd. I get a stupid grin on my face and I'm so fucking excited and speechless on the way home. And then I wake up the next day and I get to live my life. But just for, you know, that night, I felt like, holy shit, I got to be in the room with him, you know, and that meant a lot. And, you know, there's just not a lot of music that does that for you. I go to gigs all the time. And I leave and go, oh, I hope the tube's still running.
Right.
The subway, you know. But I think that's what I'm going to miss about kind of having Levon around, so to speak, is that nobody else gets to share in that experience. And I still get people that write comments in some of the blog posts I wrote about Levon, and they just start to spill out with their experiences as well. And he's not playing on my blog, you know. He's not commenting on my blog. But you get a couple people talking about it, and you get that same heightened spirituality, sense of, you know, fulfillment out of it, and nobody else gets to do that anymore. And that really sucks.
Amen, Judd. That was beautiful.
The old neighborhood just ain't the same. Nobody knows just what became of Ophelia. Tell me what went wrong. Was it something that somebody said? Mama, I know we broke the rule. Was somebody up against the law? Honey, you know I'd die for you. Ashes of laughter, the ghost is clear. Why do the best things always disappear? Like Ophelia, please darken my door.
And that's going to do it for this special podcast tribute to Levon Helm. Thanks, Judd, for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
It was our pleasure. As always, go to popdos.com for links to everything we discussed today, including Judd's adventure at the Midnight Ramble. Follow us on Twitter at popdos, and you can find back episodes of the show on iTunes. And while you're there, please leave us a review because it helps give the show greater exposure. And we'll be back with another show, as I mentioned at the top. I can't really say when that's going to be, but we definitely will be back. I have to write. I have to speak these things out before I write them.
We'll be back soonish.
Yes, we'll be back soonish.
I think we should. I think we should rent a barn for the next one, and then bring some people along and kind of like do it right there on some Persian rugs and see how that goes.
Yes,
that
the live awesome. Album. Do our live album.
I'll All bring right, the guys. Pies.
Okay.
So the moral of the story is that it's good. It's a good thing Levon sang.
Yeah, yeah.
He would have been a hell of a lot more anonymous if he hadn't been able to sing.
And also that he had friends who could give him work. I mean, you think of, you know, the all-star band tours, Ringo's bands.
Yeah, God, man, those tours are cheesy, but somebody should put up a monument to Ringo at some point because he has probably rescued more than one musician from, you know,
yeah,
senior citizen poverty.
Dave Edmonds.
Right, exactly, Dave.
You know?
We call it the Dave Edmonds Monument.
Yeah. but yeah, I mean, like, who else was hiring Joe Walsh in 1990? And Clarence.
Well, shit, who else was hiring? I gotta think that even for a guy like Jack Blades or Roger Hodgson, it's probably a more high-profile, better-paying gig than what you're going to get when you're on your own. I mean, I giggle every time I see that they're going back on the road, but from that standpoint, that's a pretty important band.
Yeah, and you think, okay, who's so far down on the D-list?
It's like, the VH1 Celebrity Fit Club of right. summer tours.
Is that right?
Sal Nunziato of the Burning Wood Block, which, Jeff, I know you read. Judd, do you
yes,
read that?
I do.
No, I don't.
For his new release, you know, on Tuesday he does his new releases, and for Ringo's last album, he's like, I just love that this guy's still around and making music. This isn't very good, but I love the idea of it. I love that he's And it's true. It's like, you see that Ringo's got something, it's like, yeah, Ringo, all right.
That's
and you're
a perfect review for every Ringo record.
Right. Exactly.